Hello, I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On this week's episode, anime, Avatar The Last Airbender, and How to Train Your Dragon. My guest this week has been a lot of different people. He grew up a meek kid in Maryland, came out of the closet when he went to school in New York to study illustration, and then had to watch his step when his first job out of college required him to move to Tennessee to work on the religious show VeggieTales. For a while, he found solace in the fandom of queer anime, and then when he was finally able to escape Tennessee, it was to a city and a job where queerness could be celebrated. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder to check out my YouTube channel, where I post videos about queer pop culture, and head over to Patreon to watch hours of bonus videos featuring stories of TV and film history. I also just posted a roundup on Patreon of the most downloaded episodes of Sewers in 2021, along with my most watched YouTube videos, so check that out. Also, check out my cute little newsletter, where I share sneak peeks at what I'm working on at mattbaume.com. Big thanks to everyone who supports The Sewers of Paris at patreon.com/mattbaume, and to everybody who's left a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Now, here's my conversation with Andy. Well, this week I'm talking to Andy Cassadante, a story artist. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, what is the entertainment that changed your life?
That would be the anime series Revolutionary Girl Utena.
Oh, great. We have never talked about that on the show, and it's something that's always been on my list to watch. So tell me all about it.
Really?
Like, sell it to me as like a total newcomer.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Oh, God. I don't even know where to begin.
Tell me about like how you found it. Like, when did it become a part of your life?
I found it somewhere around like 2015, 2016. I don't quite remember exactly where in there. Mm-hmm. But I actually discovered it through an art blog. I think it was like an old Tumblr where the artist was somebody that I already like was a big fan of. And they were posting all these like fan art pieces from the series, from Utena. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what is this? Like, why does it sound so cool from like the description this artist is writing? And so I looked into it and it never really resurfaced from that well. It's just like now my obsession.
Okay. What is it about, and who are the like favorite characters?
So the series is, it's about a lot of things, but the premise of it is that the main character is this girl, Utena Tenjo, who starts a year at a new school, and she dresses in like a boy's uniform. Like she comes in and she's like, you know, I don't do girly things. I play sports. I'm like, you know, kind of a guy's gal, or, you know, whatever the modern equivalent of that would be.
Like a tomboy?
Kind of, yeah. But she does all these things because when she was little, her parents died, and an actual like prince on a white horse showed up and told her like, never give up. Don't let like life get you down. And basically like sort of exemplified the fairy tale ideal of like princeliness and heroism to her. Mm. And rather than sort of doing that thing of like, oh, like that was my prince, I'll wait for you to return one day, or I hope to find somebody like you someday, she instead is like, I'm going to be a prince because I aspire to do what he did to me for others. So her like boyish traits, I guess, are her sort of trying to emulate princeliness. And the series gets pretty weird pretty fast. Like she shows up at this school and she winds up entangled in a series of magical sword fights that take place among like the student council members at the school. And they're competing to win the power to revolutionize the world.
Okay, something to be said there for like, let's have some stakes.
Oh yeah, yeah. The series is like 0 to 100, and it really doesn't take a lot of time to explain things to you. Mm-hmm. Like one of the coolest storytelling things that the series does is that it constantly is withholding crucial information until like the very last minute. Mm-hmm. So you'll be confused about most things until basically the end of the series, which is a pretty bold move, but I think really, really works. And yeah, the series is just Utena winds up entangled in the duels. Oh, and also the current champion of the duels, like whoever is currently winning the most duels, becomes engaged to this girl who calls herself the Rose Bride. And she's kind of like subservient to the person who currently like owns her. It's really weird. And it's one of those things that on the surface is like, you know, you look at it nowadays and kind of raise an eyebrow at that entire thing. But it's done in a very like conscious and purposeful way. Like it's not supposed to be ever like looked at as, oh, this is a good thing that's happening, that this girl is essentially a piece of property.
Did you like, was, did somebody recommend it to you, or did you just like happen to click on the right thing?
It really was just like I saw those fan arts, and then I like looked up the series, and I think it's all still like just available for free on YouTube.
Oh wow, great. Like, my favorite kind of anime.
I know, right? Like it's hardly even work. I think it's all still there, but it definitely was when I first looked into it, and they had like the whole series like in Japanese with subtitles. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of was like, let's just go and see what's going on here, because you know that artist was really like raving about it, and I was like, well, there's got to be something good going on here. And it very quickly like proved itself to be, at the very least, visually striking and like very unusual. Mm-hmm. But the sort of depth and like all the stuff that really makes it like stick, and what I guess has made it really stand the test of time, that stuff comes like very, very slowly, and then you kind of get hit with it all at the end, and a lot of the series gets recontextualized by learning like that information.
Was anime like, was it a big part of your life? Like, had you been watching a lot of similar shows when you found this one?
Kind of. I was definitely like kind of an anime kid in high school. Like I watched a fair bit of anime, but I never was really like ravenous about it. I tended to just like watch a handful of shows and keep up with them like really intensely. Mm-hmm. Rather than watching like a lot of things and not really like diving in very deep.
Which were the ones that you were like keeping up with intensely?
I mean, not necessarily things that I'm like super proud of now, but you know, back then it was stuff like, you know, the big titles like Bleach and Naruto, just because everybody talked about those. And then what else? I know there were like some sort of oddball ones. I know that like the first one that I found like early in college that was pretty similar, that is similar in some ways to Utena, was Evangelion, Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Yeah.
That one has, I think, a fair bit of like thematic overlap, or at least like tonal overlap, maybe would be the better way to put it. But that one sort of clicked with me in a similar way that Utena clicked with me, but Utena definitely clicked way more. And I think that might be because Utena is a little bit more of a like unified, finished vision. Whereas Ava had like all these problems while it was being made.
A lot of starts. There's
a lot of
ways in to that series.
That one almost feels like a harder recommendation from me now, even though Utena is like 40 episodes long. Like, that sounds long by modern standards. But with Ava, it's like, okay, well, you have to start at this one point, and then you got to do all these other things in order to get the actual story.
Like, I feel like Evangelion for me is like Kingdom Hearts, where it's fun, but you also need someone sitting there to be like, okay, listen, the thing with this part is, like, you just need to have like a little bit of a guide.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt. I was also a big Kingdom Hearts fan, and you are definitely not wrong. Like, I find myself now, like, when I recommend the series to people, like, nowadays, who never played it, or who maybe only ever played, like, the first one as a kid, it's like, it does feel kind of overwhelming until you kind of break it down, and you're like, no, okay, you go in this order, and you kind of just hang on for the ride.
Yeah, it's very like, just let it wash over you.
Yes. Truly.
When you found Utena, it sounds like she might have been like, you might have just been a little past high school, or were you the same age as the characters?
Oh, sorry, I should have clarified that. When I found Utena, I would have been in like my early 20s, like maybe 22. It was right after I finished college, and I was working at my first job.
What did you go to college for illustration, or what was the education like?
I actually went specifically for illustration, and then I sort of assumed that I would wind up doing, you know, like magazine illustrations or like book illustrations, something like that. Mm-hmm. And then almost by like happenstance, I sort of stumbled into animation.
And how did that happen?
Just sort of an accident. Like I wound up connected with a school alumni through one of my teachers. And I was doing like a little bit of freelance work for him, because I think he was working like multiple shows at the time. And he wanted to like help like teach about to graduate seniors like, oh, if you want to get into background illustration or like any kind of animation, I'll help you, like, coach you through some of this work. And, you know, at the same time, you can help me work through some of this stuff. It just kind of happened that at, like, right around that time, a job opening occurred on one of the shows that he was working on. And he was like, do you storyboard? And I just lied and said that I did. And
was that terrifying? Were you like,
oh, it was so terrifying, especially when they actually took me. Because I had, like, almost no, like, real credentials to show. But I think because the show wasn't in California, it was in, like, Tennessee. So I think just because there weren't a lot of maybe options for them, they were like, yeah, we'll take a crack at the college kid and see what he turns out. And then I spent, like, the better part of the first year at that job just kind of scrambling to keep my head above water.
What was the stuff that you basically envisioned yourself illustrating? Like, what did you like to draw, and what were you looking forward to doing? Like, when you thought you were going to do books and magazines, and then what was the reality of it when you came onto that show?
I guess I didn't have, like, a super, super clear picture of, like, exactly what I wanted to do. I figured, you know, if you get into book illustration, it tends to be, you know, a lot of, what would you call it? Like, a lot of, like, scenes with, like, human figures. Like, I like drawing people the most. And most books that get illustrations are, like, either kids' books or you're illustrating, like, covers of maybe, like, young adult novels. So all of that stuff, you know, it sometimes leans, like, kind of fantasy, sometimes leans, like, very high adventure kind of stuff. Like, I thought those things would be pretty fun. But overall, I just like the idea of, you know, telling a story in limited pictures. And then, you know, jumping into being a story artist, it was kind of the same thing, and then also not the same thing at all. Because, like, in illustration, you have to wrap, like, so much information into, like, basically a single image. Like, a single image has to do a lot of communicating. Whereas when you're storyboarding, you're doing, like, thousands of drawings that are communicating, like, one idea at a time. Because when something's moving on a screen, like, the human eye can't process a ton of information at once. Sure. So it was like a similar idea, but executed, like, completely differently. So there was a little bit of a learning curve.
What was the show?
It was the Netflix reboot series for VeggieTales.
Oh, I didn't know that happened.
Yeah, it did. It was quite a time. It was probably a good show to try to learn how to storyboard on, because the characters are all just little blobs, you know, like, they're all circles. So there wasn't a lot of, like, having to worry about technical skills. It was more just like, how do you set up a shot, or, you know, how do you, like, move a camera, without having to worry about also drawing, like, appropriate looking human figures.
Sure, sure. So you're starting with some kind of simple shapes, I guess.
Yeah, it was lucky for sure.
And were you working remotely?
No, actually, I was working in Tennessee for 3 years on that show, because we got 3 full seasons.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, you're doing something right.
Well, that was also, like, right back at the start of, like, the sort of Netflix original series boom. And around that time, I believe Netflix was basically just green lighting, like, multiple seasons of a show at the outset. Like, I think if I remember correctly, we knew, like, at the beginning that we were basically, like, in for 3 seasons, but at the same time, the showrunners had to essentially repitch the show at the end of every season to, like, guarantee the next season's pickup. So I guess it was, like, kind of guaranteed that we had 3, but we still had to kind of prove we were doing good work.
Sure. And were you from Tennessee, or did you, you know, had you been there?
Nope. That was just totally, totally new. I'm from Maryland originally, and I'd been going to school in upstate New York. So the jump to Tennessee was pretty wild. Like, it was very, very unexpected in some ways. And I definitely never would have predicted that for myself.
Yeah. So it's not like a fully cross country move, but I imagine, like, it was a big cultural adjustment going, especially from New York.
Oh yeah. It definitely was. It was nice that the studio was pretty close to Nashville.
Okay.
So there was still kind of like, you know, a city vibe to the area. Like you could definitely go and it would feel a little bit more, you know, like stuff I was used to. But the all the surrounding areas, it was like, wow, this is not at all what I'm accustomed to, either, you know, from the time growing up or the time in college.
Yeah. Did you feel like cut off from the rest of the world there? Or did you just like, I don't know, like I have no context for, was it a small town? Was it rural? Like, what was it like?
I guess it was basically a small town. We were about 20 minutes away from the city. Mm-hmm. But it was small and I believe like pretty wealthy. Like it was an area where it was like a lot of like bigger scale houses. I think it was still like sort of on like the very edge of the touristy areas for Nashville. So a lot of stuff was like very like overly kept. Gardens really manicured, like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it was an adjustment. It was just very different, a very different sort of thing. And I was also pretty far away from everybody that I knew, mm-hmm. you know, because like my family was back in Maryland and most of my friends from school, even if they weren't from, you know, any part of New York, they weren't from Tennessee, mm-hmm. Or really anywhere near there. A lot of them were from northern states. So it was a strange like experience, but not necessarily a bad one most of the time. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a good place to start, like to start out a career, because stuff wasn't very expensive there. Mm-hmm. You know, like the cost of living wasn't crazy high the way that it is like here in Los Angeles. And if I had like started out here, I think things would have been a lot more difficult for a lot of reasons, mm-hmm. Just as far as, you know, like having money like to pay for things.
Sure.
It was also like a strange sort of like I guess mindset going in there, because knowing that it was basically going to be 3 years but probably no more than 3 years, because like most of us figured like the show will probably last the 3 years that we're sort of banking on. Mm-hmm. But after that, like there's no other like animation work out here. Basically we would have to move to California. Those 3 years were kind of like, they felt almost a little, they felt kind of like, you know, I'm here, but I don't want to put down roots because like, I won't be here for more than like maximum of 3 years. So it was like, I was able to, you know, buddy up and make friends with people who worked on the show, but I didn't really want to like make close friends with people who were like actual locals locals who weren't working with us, because it's like, well, like nothing can really like come of this. So it was mm-hmm. kind of sad for that reason.
What was the, I guess the vibe, for as far as like queer culture, both like in Tennessee and also like at the job? Cause you know, when I think of VeggieTales, it like makes me a little nervous to hear. Cause I'm like, uh-oh, something religious. Is this dangerous?
Yeah. So that was something that I went in like pretty nervous about. And like, I stop me if I get like a little like too in depth about this, but I had like only recently, like, I think it was during my senior year in college, actually, was when I actually came out, like to, in general, like to most of my friends. I still wasn't out to my family at the time, but, like I had really like just kind of gotten to a point where I was comfortable with it. And then as soon as I realized like, oh, the job is in Tennessee at VeggieTales, I was like, so, like, we're going to have to sort of tamp back down on this just because like, you don't totally know who to trust. And even though, you know, like at the time, I believe, yeah, VeggieTales at the time was owned by, DreamWorks. So obviously there was like, I think a little more corporate oversight going on. Like, I don't imagine they could have just outright like fired me if they had found out like that I wasn't straight, but I don't really know what would have happened if that information had like come out, as far as just workplace comfort, you know what I mean? Like it probably could have gone a lot of directions because some people that I worked with were extremely, extremely nice, like, and they're great people. And some of them, like moved out here, like along with the group of us that sort of bounced out here at the end of the show. But others were not super open-minded and, you know, I worked with a few evangelicals. So it was a mixed bag, and it was one of those things where I was like, let's just not say anything and like kind of let that be for the time being.
Yeah, that must have been really frustrating to have, like, you know, it's not easy to make the decision to like make the leap and come out, and then to be like, oh, all that work that you put in and all that like work you did on yourself, never mind.
Yeah, it wasn't my favorite thing. It definitely was the I think probably like that was the biggest downside of that first job. But at the same time, you know, that first job was such an important like learning experience for me that it's hard for me to look at it and be like, man, I wish that hadn't happened.
Yeah. So tell
overall, it was good.
What did you get out of it? Like, I you know, to be in Tennessee and to be in a place where you might not have felt entirely comfortable being yourself and like all that, like, and also to be doing a job that secretly you might not have been as prepared for as they thought you were. What kept you there, and what was, you know, what was the value for you in sticking around?
Well, there were a couple of things that initially like really kept me there, and the big one was that it was an in, like it was a way to get into the animation industry, because it's a tough industry to break into, for sure. Like a lot of people want to do it, and it typically doesn't happen very easily, and especially if you don't like have pre-established connections, like people who can remember you and be like, hey, that like up-and-comer had like a really good portfolio, like let's try to get them on this show. So but having that as like a stepping stone, you know, and having at the time like DreamWorks be the parent company, it was like, well, like at the very least 3 years working on like any kind of animated product is 3 years for your resume. So even if like we aren't kept within DreamWorks, like if we aren't, you know, offered a position on another show at the end of all this, it's now something like that we can put on a resume. And when we go out to LA, it's like, well, I've got 3 whole years of TV experience doing X job. So that part was like initially what was really motivating me. But a big part of what I sort of got out of it was, I mean, one, the people that I met there who were like really, really nice and who I've stayed in contact with since then, like they're like genuinely very good friends still. So I did get like some actual like friendships out of it. And at the same time, I also like learned the skill of storyboarding in a way that is kind of difficult to learn if you're not on a production. Like even if you went to school like for storyboarding or like for any form of like animation, typically the like the realistic needs of working on a production are different. And also like at the time, I think animation as an industry was changing a lot. So in schools, you probably weren't getting like super, super up to date, like information on what a show or a movie would need. So the director that I had at the time, like the directors, like, are the ones who work directly with the story artists and revisionists, which was what I was at the time. I was a story revisionist. So like, I was just fixing up, like I was updating boards that were already done to address notes or to like address design changes, things like that. But at the same time, like my director was very like open and willing to like teach me how to do the job, because he figured out like pretty quickly that I didn't really know what I was doing, or that, you know, even if I had gotten some education on storyboarding, it wasn't like up to date. So he took like a lot of time to actually teach me. And like, honestly, I do kind of owe a lot to him for that reason. Because like a lot of the things that he taught me at like over the course of those, you know, 2.5-3 years that I was working with him, those skills like still serve me now. And in some ways, like you know, almost over prepare me for certain shows, just because he was very on top of his work. Like he had a very high standard that he wanted followed. So that was what he taught me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then where did you go? Like, and what, so that was, I think you said it was right after college. So what years were that?
Well, I finished college in 2014. So the VeggieTales series would have lasted from 2014 to like mid 2017, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Or early 2017, I think, was when most of us were sort of rolling off the show.
Okay. And I just have to point out, like, you got really invested in this show, Utena, like a show about, you know, people, somebody coming into a new environment and having to prove themselves, like, at a time when it seemed like that is what you were going through.
I think that may have had something to do with it. Utena is also a very, like, openly queer show. Like, It has some very like potent queer themes, and obviously like the sort of the premise itself is already like a little screwy with like, you know, oh, what do gender norms matter? Like I'm a girl, but I'm gonna be a prince. And so, you know, maybe some of that stuff was also feeding into my interest of it. I was like, oh, like, you know. Like what a show to just so simply state things that are not necessarily culturally normal.
Yeah. Well, I imagine that was a relief in Tennessee, especially like, I'm just going to go on a limb here and guess that there weren't a lot of other fans. I mean, maybe even at the company or maybe I'm wrong, but like how much could you talk about anime with your coworkers?
There were a few people who I could like have like some basic discussions about it with. But not really Utena specifically. Like there were people at the company who knew like anime stuff, because you know a lot of the folks who were like brought out to work on VeggieTales like had come from California, and they'd like worked in other animation productions before. But yeah, Utena specifically was not really something I could talk with like most people there about. Certainly not in the way that I would have wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Well, so where did you go after that? Like, as the show is wrapping up?
Actually, since then, I've stayed like employed with DreamWorks for the entirety of my career, actually, which is now I think creeping up on like 8 years. I got rolled off of VeggieTales, and by the time I rolled off, I was actually working as a director. I had like over the course of the 3 years had kind of like worked my way up as people either left or, you know, departed the show for whatever reason. So they bumped me off of VeggieTales and they moved me onto a production out here. And I've kind of just stayed with them like ever since. They make a pretty like concentrated effort to keep people, like to keep their artists working rather than just saying, show's over, see you later.
Right.
So I've just kind of been bouncing from one production to another working with them.
Well, that's great, because I know, like, in animation, it can be hard to have, I guess, showbiz in general, it can be hard to have regularity and know what the next gig is going to be.
Oh, yeah.
But it sounds like you're inside a machine where you have some options.
Yeah, it's, at the very least, it offers, like, stability, which, at the moment, is helpful. Mm-hmm. you know, like, there, now that I'm out here, like, there's always, like, potential other stuff that I could look for if I ever wanted to.
What have been some highlights from the last, coming up on 8 years?
It's just strange, like, to think about it, that it's like, it has been 8 years. I guess I should ask, when you say highlights, do you mean, like, specific to, like, each show, or just, like, in general of, like, working in animation or working at DreamWorks?
Well, stuff that you've gotten to work on or that you got to do that was happy for you to do, like, stuff that was meaningful or, like, you look back on, you're like, I feel really good about that.
One of the things that I've enjoyed the most, honestly, has been, like, the crews that I've worked with. Like, basically every team that I've worked with have been like a batch of like really, really cool people. Like, not to say that the team at VeggieTales, like I said earlier, didn't have some great people, but out here, like most of the teams that I've been a part of, it's like, I like everybody. Like, everyone is so nice. And like, so like friendly and happy to talk about like, you know, the cool stuff that they like and whatever else. Like it is genuinely like a really cool environment. And I know that isn't always the case on different productions. Like you do hear stories, but I've been very lucky in that regard for sure. And then aside from that, I worked on a like a How to Train Your Dragon spinoff series that mm-hmm. was, I believe it was technically considered like preschool skewed, but it really kind of skewed a little older. It was more like the 6 to 11 age group. Mm-hmm. And that was a really, really fun production. That was actually the first production that I worked on out here. That was the one I got bumped onto. Mm-hmm. And working on that show was honestly like very cool and in a lot of ways really rewarding. Partially because it was just like it was a show that asked like so much more of like the story artists than VeggieTales did. Like VeggieTales was fun, but it was also at times like very, very basic for mm-hmm. pretty obvious reasons. You know, very, very young age group that they're aiming at. But you know, Dragons was like very at like very high adventure. There was a lot of action. There were like musical episodes that we did. So it was like this great opportunity to really like flex a lot of the skills that I had been like developing over the 3 years that I worked at VeggieTales. And it gave me a chance to like push myself more and sort of figure out like, you know, okay, what kind of stuff do I really, really enjoy doing as a board artist? And what kind of things would I want to pursue like going forward in my career?
Yeah, well, and that must have tapped in a bit more to the stuff that you were mentioning earlier, that you're expecting to do more fantasy and fantastic creatures and stuff. Mm-hmm. I imagine, like, in addition to being more technically, you know, I don't want to say sophisticated, but something more complex, right? Like, Dragon Show was probably more complex.
Oh yeah, went from not a single limb on any of the characters to drawing like a bunch of quadrupeds. So
oh no, limbs.
I was like, they have legs and wings that I have to think about. Are you kidding me?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it was cool. It was good.
Sure, sure. Well, that's great. And did you have like, I don't know, did you have passion projects during that time, like outside of work? Or was it a situation where you're like, I'm just going to do the work that I'm doing, like my day job is exhausting enough. I don't need to give myself more outside of that.
kind of a mix, actually. I have like some passion projects that I've been like trying to chip away at over the last couple of years. And it's kind of one of those things where at this point, it's like, just do it. Like, just stop like worrying about making everything like perfect and just like pursue it. Cause it's stuff that I would want to like pitch potentially as like animated shows. But at the same time, like I've moved slowly on them because a lot of the shows that I work on do demand a lot of time. Mm. And at the end of the day, it does sort of feel like, well, you know, back before COVID, it was like, I would get home from the office at the end of the day, and it would feel like, do I really want to just sit back down at a desk and like keep doing the same thing that I'm doing all day? Mm-hmm. And some days the answer was yes, but a lot of days it was like, I just kind of need to sleep, or I need to like go and exercise, like something to sort of change the pace up. But yeah, there have been like side passion projects for a few years. It's just been hard to really like fully dive into those in the way that I want to.
Do you feel like, and maybe you're like getting a lot of fulfillment out of the you know, day job work that you're doing, which is an amazing luxury to have.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Like, what is your ideal show? Like, if you could be on any show, like maybe one that doesn't even exist, like if you had to pitch your own show from scratch, what would you be working on?
I guess, I mean, the closest like comparisons I can think of that already exist are, you know, like very like well-made, well like maintained like adventure fantasy or action series. You know, obviously I feel like a big go-to for a lot of people in the industry is like Avatar the Last Airbender. Mm-hmm. Very like, it covers a lot of bases, that show. Incredible action, like incredible character writing, extremely consistent like world building. Like that's my favorite kind of storytelling. But if it was something like, as far as something that I would want to make that kind of doesn't exist yet, it would really be something kind of like Utena, which is a little difficult to explain because a lot of what makes Utena really unique, aside from some of the things that it talks about, is the way that it visually functions and like the way that the story is told. Like, mm-hmm. Utena is extremely surreal. And the show gets way weirder as it goes on, but like the weirdness is consistent. Like it's like a it is kind of a puzzle you can solve in some ways. Like, I hesitate to say it like that because there's a lot of room for interpretation of Utena, but like the symbolism and like the visual metaphors that are being used throughout the series are so reliably used in certain situations, you can easily ascribe meaning to them. It's just that the meaning may change depending on the viewer.
Hmm. Well, what's the meaning that you see?
Oh, that's complicated. I'm trying to think of like an easy way to sort of put it that isn't super spoilery. I mean, it depends, because there are like really big like symbolic ideas that appear throughout the series. Like the series focuses a lot on the process of adolescence in a way that you don't see in a lot of things. Like, obviously there's a lot of coming of age stories, but Utena really hones in on like why adolescence is complicated and like why growing up can be so painful for some people. It kind of ascribes to, I don't know if this is like the actual literary term for it, but it ascribes to a like destructive form of adolescence where, rather than, you know, oh, you're a child and you have certain ways of thinking and becoming an adult means building upon those ideas, like a destructive like style of adolescence is the notion that you have to like destroy who you were as a child, because like when you were a kid, you held too many false notions about what it meant to be an adult and like what the world was really like. And so essentially you have to go through this sort of painful process of like destroying your old self to build your new self as like a functioning adult. And like, I don't know if I always fully agree with that like concept, but I think Utena tackles it in a really interesting and unique way. And, you know, that's one of those things that really, I think, makes it stand out. Like, you don't see that sort of thing very often.
Do you feel like that's something that you've had to do? Like, you know, destroy the younger you to become the newer, bigger, better you?
Yeah, I would definitely say in a lot of ways, I think that's been how I've kind of had to grow up. And maybe that is part of why Utena resonates with me so much, is like, you know, when you're younger, and you realize like, oh, I'm not straight, you do kind of have to destroy a lot of the ideas that you had built up for yourself about what your future is going to look like. Mm-hmm. Like that inherently does change. And then, you know, there are things that come sort of attached to that, that you now have to figure out, how does this factor into what my new future could be? And then same thing, even with like, you know, political stances. You know, like as you get older, like you grow up like hearing certain things from your parents, hearing things from people around you, and you internalize those sometimes without really thinking about them. And you're just like, oh, well, adults are saying that and I trust these adults, so obviously those opinions are correct. And at certain times, you do have to like readjust and maybe abandon those ideas that you were sort of instilled with. And I've definitely had that experience.
How does it compare? Like, if you look back at like who you were in Tennessee and then who you were in New York or Maryland, like what are those people? Like, you know, the thing that they have in common, I guess, is that they were all you, but maybe that one thing that they all have in common doesn't matter. Like how are they all different?
Well, I mean, I look back at who I was basically all the way through high school, and like, I can't really fathom being that person anymore. Because like when I look back at that person, I was much like, well, one, I grew up in like a pretty conservative household. So like inherently that's quite different now. Like I lean pretty far left these days. And at the same time, I was also really like meek when I was younger, I think partially because I was like afraid. Like I knew from like pretty early on that I wasn't straight. And I think there was a part of me that was like afraid that, oh, if I talk too much or if I like exhibit too much of myself, people will read between the lines and figure out who I am. And so I was like very, very passive, very, very quiet. You know, like some of my like cousins hardly even heard me speak when we would like visit them for the holidays or whatever. And so that feels so unfathomable now when, like, overall, I'm like a pretty opinionated, talkative person. And honestly, like, the stages between like who I was in high school and as a kid versus who I am now, like all of the phases between that, like when I was in college, when I was in Tennessee, all of those are just sort of incremental steps leaning from one to the other. So like, obviously in college was when I felt a little more comfortable starting to talk more. It was where I found like the security and like the stable sense of self to actually like come out and mm-hmm. really let people know who I actually was.
Was that because it just felt like a more supportive environment?
I think it was because college was honestly the first place where I really like made a solid group of friends. Like, I had some good friends in high school, and some of them are still my friends, like, to this day. But there was something about, like my illustration class was, I think, maybe, like, 30 people. Like, it wasn't a very big year that we had. Like, I think the illustration major tended to stay pretty small, at least it used to. I don't know if it still does. But we all kind of got to know each other, like, really well over the first, like, few years of our major. And it turned out we all liked each other quite a bit. Like, there weren't really any personalities that bumped or like rubbed up against each other in the wrong way. So everybody in that major got really, really tight knit with each other. Obviously there were like little groups within the big group, but basically everybody was friends. And so there was a sense of like, I've never felt stability like this before. Like, I've never felt if I were to come out to one person, they like this person, even if word got out, I could trust everybody else that they would potentially mention it to. Not that any of them ever would, like, even say anything against my will. Like, everybody who I came out to was like, that's great. Like, what do you need me to do? Like, how do you need me to, like, act around, like, these other people who don't know yet? Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like, you know, it was the first time I really felt like everybody here, like, has my back and we are all a unit. Because like I said, the friends that I had in high school, I would have trusted them for sure, but it's also like, that's only one person. And it still feels like a little bit scary, because then it's like, well, now it's just two people guarding what at the time it felt like had to be a secret. Mm-hmm. So I think it was I guess that was sort of like my first big, like, found family. I don't know if that's like an overused sort of phrase, but that was like the tightest knit family, like, type of thing that I had ever really found, aside from my real family. But obviously there were like other fears baked into that.
It does sound like at college, is it fair to say that felt for the first time, or maybe the most that you had ever felt that other people would defend you and that it was a group of people who really were looking out for each other?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. Although I don't know, again, if it's necessarily that those were the first people who would have done that. It isn't that I think my like high school friends wouldn't have been trustworthy or that they wouldn't have like had my back in the same way. But there was something about like us all knowing each other so well as like a group in college where, and maybe it was also like the separation from, this sounds darker than it is, but maybe it was the separation from my family, because it's not that I didn't love my family or think that they wouldn't eventually be on board with it, but I wasn't ready to tell them. Mm-hmm. And there was something maybe a little scary about telling anybody within like the same zip code as my parents, because it's like, what if they somehow like put it together? What if they somehow figured it out? And that like scared the hell out of me at the time. So that also may have had something to do with it, was like, we're like this tight knit group and it felt like a totally different world, like to be in this new place with these new people. And like, I felt like I could trust them all.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a real value to having an opportunity to start, not start over, but to, I guess, have like a save point or like,
yeah,
be like, I'm gonna try something different.
Yeah, yeah, maybe that's a good way to put it.
Yeah,
yeah, but for sure.
So where do you find yourself now? You're in LA and you've been working pretty steadily. How do you like? I don't know, there's a hard thing to do, but when you compare yourself to like the places you've been, how do you describe the work that you do and the person, like the person that you consider yourself?
Well, I guess it's tough to say that honestly. And like in the age of COVID, it's like, who really is anyone now? But I mean, I'm still working in kids animation at the moment, still working for DreamWorks, and honestly, still having a really good time doing it. Like the show that I'm currently on is like, it's really fun. It's also got kind of an action-y spin to it, which is a bonus for me. And I guess like, sorry, what was the second part of the question?
How do you describe like outside of your work, like, you know, I think you said you felt more opinionated and it's easier for you to like speak your mind. Like, you know, just how do you describe yourself as a person compared to who you used to be?
I guess just like way more, at times a little more abrasive than I used to be, but kind of in a good way. Like I don't dislike the fact that now I'm more like talkative and opinionated, even if my opinions aren't always correct. Like I used to worry so much about that of like, what if I say the wrong thing or what if I have the wrong opinion? And it's like, that kind of thing doesn't matter as much now. It's like, if I have the wrong opinion, like, I mean, I guess there's debate about like, you know, is there such a thing as a wrong opinion? And it's like, there are about some things, but the stuff that matters, it's like, if I have the wrong opinion, I can learn. I feel like I can, you know, take criticism and learn from it rather than just being like, oh God, I'm garbage. Like, I can't believe I had the wrong take.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was just talking to somebody else about this, like the value of learning. I don't know, to give yourself permission to be imperfect. Like it's one of the hardest things to do. Like it's easy to say that you want to do that, but it's hard to actually give yourself permission to be like, oh, I screwed something up, or I messed up, or I was wrong about something, or whatever. That's like a piece of growth. Like admitting that you still have more growth to do is challenging.
Oh yeah. And I think it's really important. And honestly, I feel like people need to think a little bit more about that at the moment. Like there is a lot of like knee-jerk reactions that I see. I guess more easily I see it in like the online spaces, you know, like social media sites, where there isn't a lot of flexibility or like room for forgiveness offered when someone makes a mistake. Like it's something that I feel like we need to think a little bit more about, because like everybody's just learning, and everybody, I mean, the people who care to learn, like the people who actually are like trying to do better and trying to like be better to others and be better people, it's like they're for the large part they are trying, and it doesn't really do any good to like, you know, jump down their throats or dogpile them when they're like, when they mess up. It's like, because they're the people who will take that to heart and be really hurt by it. And then there are other people who are just like the absolute worst, who have no incentive to ever get better. And like, they just brush all that stuff off. Like that kind of criticism doesn't affect those types of people. So I don't know. I'm like, maybe we just need to be a little more like empathetic about like people's growth or people's journeys or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, and I wonder to what extent, like being in LA now, being in an environment where there's just probably a lot more diversity, I'm going to guess, than Tennessee.
Oh, yeah.
And in particular, like a lot more queerness and different flavors of queer. How's that impacted your life to be in a place where there's so many opportunities to explore?
I mean, honestly, basically in all, a majority of good ways, I would say. It's obviously like not always perfect, but it is just so refreshing to be in like the first like real place that I've lived where it's like there is just an air of queerness about. Like there are just queer people everywhere out here. You know, it doesn't feel as like strange as it did in any of the other places that I've lived to be queer or to see other queer individuals. Like even in college, you know, like college is still kind of a messy like situation where it's like you don't quite know what's going on. Like you're maybe not totally secure in your own identity yet. Like it isn't quite the same. And, you know, obviously being out here, there are tons of actual queer spaces that you can, like, go into, theoretically. You know, but in non-COVID times, you can go into all of these, like, queer spaces and just be surrounded by other people who are either like you or have shared, like, a similar kind of journey, you know? Like, they at least get the idea of what you have gone through.
What is, you know, it's impossible to say what the future holds, but, you know, looking forward, recording this just at the end of 2021, is there stuff that you want to do in 2022? Like, stuff that you're looking forward to either when pandemic ends, like, you know, and I'm going on a limb to say that it's going to happen, but stuff that you're looking forward to or that you want to try once you can do the thing you were just talking about, like, go out and try something new.
It's tough to say. Like, honestly, 2021's been a rough year. Like, just mentally for me, because it's been so, like, complicated with, you know, the pandemic's over, the pandemic's not over, it's actually getting worse. Like, it felt very emotionally tumultuous. So I haven't thought very much about, like, what even is going to happen next year? Like, what do I want? Because, you know, it's so hard to say, like, what could even be possible. But best case scenario, I guess I would really, really like to, this is like the most cliche, I feel like, possible thing I could say, but I'd really like to travel. I'd love to see some stuff. just because I've been so sedentary for the last 2 years, but that would be a big one. I'd love to, you know, get out of the country and see some stuff, across the pond, or is that the phrase, across the pond?
Sure.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, we've all been cooped up for a long time.
Yeah. I would love to do that. As far as smaller scale stuff though, I mean, I would sort of really like to get to a point where I can start maybe, like, you know, pitching my own ideas around, like, to like whatever studios, see if I can finally get some concrete, like, material to show. Mm-hmm. And see if people are interested in that kind of thing, because that's been sort of on, like, the to-do list basically since 2015. You know, as soon as I started working in animation, I found out, it's like, oh yeah, like, anyone, like, in the industry usually can kind of find a way into a pitch room. It sometimes just takes a bit of work. It's something that I've wanted to do for quite some time. And luckily, that one doesn't even hinge on an end to the pandemic. That one, like, people have been pitching over Zoom calls, like, all the way through the last 2 years. So that one can happen independently of whatever goes on in the world.
Well, that's really exciting. Like, having the opportunity, yeah, hopefully, fingers crossed, to go out and explore and find something new, and also the opportunity to go out and, or maybe even stay in and make something new, like, finding stuff and making stuff. That sounds like good stuff to look forward to.
I hope so. And hopefully it all works out. I would love that.
You know, things have a way of doing that. Like, when you think back to, like, at least this is the case for me, when I think back to all the times I was like, I hope this works out. And I look at how things are now, I'm like, well, roughly speaking, they did.
It's true. Yeah. I mean, that, I feel like that is true of basically anything. It's like, everything ends eventually. You know, for better or worse, like, good things end, bad things end.
Sure. But things just move along.
Things just keep right on moving. Yeah. Like, I have to tell myself that sometimes. It's like, you know, the pandemic in whatever form will eventually end. It just depends, you know, what's that going to look like? What kind of world is it on the other side? But I'm curious to find out, at least.
Me too. Andy, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to Andy for joining me, and thanks to you for listening. And thanks to everybody who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/MattBaum to support the show and get backer rewards like stickers in the mail and exclusive bonus videos. Check out my YouTube for deep dives into queer pop culture history at youtube.com/MattBaum and my newsletter at mattbaum.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Comptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.